Desert boy and a stick. Bent, broken, beaten, battered, baked. No fake, that boy. Went out too late after Ma broke the glass beer bottle holding our landlady, smashing against her ass last year. That boy, tender, soft, beyond all knowing, or Asia. Where he read one night under the covers, "Lights out, go to sleep now," about an old Chinaman who had made thousands of horses out of red clay, peered at a temple far away, looked at a photo of naked men diving for pearls under the water. Gotta get out of here. Can't stand the smell of beer or burnt tires either. Gotta cut my hair. Don't like school. No friends. No recess. No study hour. Only to have the cool blue water slipping by my thighs, smooth beneath the pearl diver's gaze. A dolphin. Tomorrow, tomorrow, slicing the waves, racing along the bow of their boat, bobbing up and down and down and down and down. Splash.
You wanted to know about the hill. It's my whole life. I mean, I don't know what to say beyond that. I guess everything I do in the end leads me back to this hill. So it's everything for me. I dream about it. I dream about the hill a lot, yeah. I don't know how to go into those dreams. The hill is a fingerprint. Probably my finger. We all leave fingerprints. So somebody described it too as a collect call to the future. In the late 70s, I decided to go to Texas during the oil boom of 78 or 79 and work for Tom Brown Drilling Company in Odessa, Midland as a roughneck. I was lead tong and chain tong for a while. When I had time off, which in the oil boom time meant you had to quit your rig, I would come back to El Paso because I liked it so much for reasons that I still can't put my finger on. I like the food here. So maybe that's a reason. And I like these winds. And the first day I ever came here, there was a windstorm, not unlike the windstorm we have now, but even maybe more ferocious. And I somehow loved the taste of that sand in my mouth. And I settled here to work on this hill, where I didn't find the hill till about 82, 83, but I came here and I lived at the YMCA for a while and then looked for the hill. Eventually found a 100-acre tract that where I could build this thing that I eventually built, which you're going to see. So we're driving through high arid desert. Thank you. There are no trees really to speak of, except a few along the roadside where they get moisture under the highway, from under the highway. We're driving through country that is has lots of cactus, yucca cactus, and greasewood. And the countryside, I think, is beautiful. It's rolling, rolling high desert. We get snow here. We're up 4,000 feet. On a clear day, and maybe even today, probably it's not quite that clear, you can see 100 miles in every direction. And you can see all the way down into Mexico. And you can see up into New Mexico. And there are these beautiful mountains we're about to see now. And there's sun. Actually, it's a very beautiful day we're seeing. We're seeing sunlight filter through clouds and sort of dappling the countryside. And we're seeing blue sky as well. And we're seeing hundreds of thousands of acres at one time as we drive towards the hill. It's raining right now, which is a real treat for us because we don't get rain. We're in a drought. 5-year drought. When we have sandstorms, we can have winds 50, 60 miles an hour, just shy of being hurricane force. The winds are so strong that you're lucky to see 200 and 300 feet in front of you, and everybody puts their car lights on. And if the wind starts blowing from California and it just picks up speed and it comes all the way across Arizona, New Mexico, and hits my buildings broadside. It's really wonderful. I love it.
The day is paradise overcast. A breeze blows past me as you, breathless, hurry out the door, spreading riddles among the tracks you left behind in our driveway. And near the field, I've seen it all before. The sheets of glass, thin wafers of time gathering together from within the beginning, so dim a light 4,000 or 5,000 years across, lost at odd angles to one another, floating above a sea of alfalfa north of the highway near Del City. And there, beneath the sky, drained of laughter, void of pity, you sit, my Louie, on your tractor, forever smiling, your deranged motor running, soon to sow another row of ditties, your mother's songs about what went wrong with her children's children. So loud you sing, no children has Louie, that the grass bends over near a swirling eddy, a dust devil spiraling down from the cloud, a restless day, a rainless day. My teeth feel gritty. You begin to sing. You begin to pray. But I'm not ready. I'm never ready. Louie's song.
Judgment insecta am I, diptera, coleoptera, lord of all praying mantis and magpies, butterflies, dragonflies, houseflies, aphids and thrips by the millions of gillions of red ants, black ants, swarm white ants, henceforth to be known throughout my realm as termites, asopterus, mopterus, ad infinitum, I, grand patriarch of the Westfield of Hutspeth, bow down in servitude to all living and dead, short worms, long worms, wiggly worms and night crawlers, to all hornets and wasps, honeybees, bumblebees, fishflies, stylops, locusts and gnats, cicadas, crickets by the umptillions of zillions, I, lord of leafhoppers, ladybugs, bedbugs, bugs, black beetles and boll weevils, louse and lice, I, woofer believer in the light, weaver of light, thin into a canopy of symphonies, all celestial centipedes, manipedes, mosquitoes, magpies, apple pies, cherry pies, peach pies, lemon meringue pies, for my eyes have eaten up the crust. Nothing is left on my plate, lust unto dust without dismay as the sun moves across the sky this day, singing above the maddening swarms so that over my hairy legs springeth forth a buttocks and a grove of tall elders, as does the earth enter the earth and the waters join the waters, so does my fear, flow backwards into my groin as I supplicate the smooth roundness of your grace and the soft curve of your forgiveness, so that dare I praise our stained bedsheets even as the floodgates burst forth unto the morning fury, unbuttoning my shirt, unzipping my fly, untethering my belt, melting into you, my mother of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, forsaken by a fifth lover, recycled by a sixth leg, spread eagle, mouth open, ears unplugged, your plump pink bottom splitting the sheath of my bar stool, I, Louie Lou, I repent and repaired beyond all confines, and by thee, my holy moly tractor, bleeding the earth with your blade, I know that my licking your song, my song has sung no wrong. Amen.
Well, you know, it seems like something that's been rooted there for a long time, like something, you know, you might see in Egypt or some, you know, the way he has built those stone bases and those stone walls and steel doors. And you know, when you walk in, I mean, there is a sense of some, I guess, just from the forms that he uses, they're like altar pieces. So there is a sense of some kind of devotional image, but with you know, the materials that it's composed of course, are you know, just so often he uses discarded materials or industrial materials or sometimes very ephemeral materials like rose petals and paprika, things that you use for seasoning and not for its color in the art. So this kind of mixture of all these materials, I don't think quite you know what to make of it at first. Someone who takes, you know, these materials you would never anticipate being put into a form of some kind of meaning, some kind of profound meaning that you can't immediately put your hand on. But I think he also has that kind of divine touch. When I first opened the relationship, it was only with Annabelle. I met James McGee first, but he was very, you know, he was not willing to exhibit his art in a gallery at the time. So I opened a relationship with Annabelle. She's the first one we showed. We started from scratch. You know, Annabelle didn't have any kind of notoriety or name for herself, didn't even have a real resume. You know, like the art school she went to or the museums that she was in. I mean, it was this resume that was, you know, a school librarian. So, but people bought the work anyway, even though it wasn't really tied to the art world. It was shown in an art gallery, but it wasn't with assurances of people, you know, Annabelle rising to stardom. They loved it and they bought it because they loved it without any other concern. But as Annabelle, as we've sold out shows, basically Annabelle's the only artist we've exhibited where we've actually sold out shows. And so I've seen a market being built. I mean, she's really one of the artists I've seen where we've been kind of responsible for the rises in prices, working with Annabelle to raise the prices, which now they're around $8,000. Most of them are $5,000 to $8,000. But still with this great following. And the thing that touches me, too, is that the people, they aren't all wealthy people. One woman who bought an Annabelle for $5,000, she pays us $100 a month to get it. She's a school teacher. We, in showing her work, did her own bio. You know, we had a tape recording with her voice guiding people through the exhibit that we did. And, you know, it didn't cause any kind of concern until pieces started selling. And then people knew Annabelle was someone. They weren't quite sure who she was. When we felt like we had to have some kind of more thorough explanation was when we began selling things, which happened right away. I mean, we sold lots of pieces right away, people buying them without really knowing who Annabelle was, but then wanting to know more and more specifics. Well, you know, Annabelle lived in his boiler room and things like that. I mean, we never spoke about it directly, but I knew the relationship. Gradually through, you know, just talking to Jim, we began defining Annabelle as a persona of James McGee. I mean, I would just kind of explain to people. But when they would talk to Jim directly, he would always be indirect. As, you know, still talking about Annabelle in the third person. She was in more than one book. She was in an American landscape book, which pleased us because it's kind of Annabelle is some kind of spokesperson for the Southwest. Susan, it was a coffee table book on the American landscape, and then this new book on flora done by Edward Lucy Smith. There's a certain gentleness to Annabelle, and a certain, although some of the subjects are very tough subjects, and a complete lack of pretension, I think, in Annabelle, that just kind of draws people emotionally. The colors and things, without getting too overly intellectualized about it, but the colors are drawn out of this region. Annabelle, she kind of has processed the border region in a very unselfconscious way, but people, I think when they see her work, they go, you know, like, this is who we are. We love this work, without analyzing it too much.
On the south side shore side, 3 degrees starboard, the sun sets blue above the clouds of Torcello, the tide rolling in, and Maria, on a thin white pillow of foam, floats through the glass wall onto the veranda out towards the Adriatic, onto the Sea of Cortez. Her hair curling around the door frame had you reached her in time. Her cello pressed up against her shoulder. A bucket full of fresh mackerel at her feet. Years ago, when you were a budding boy painter lapping up against a sunset seascape, no lines converging along the sand. Only old hands now clamming with a wooden stick. The light drops. The blue skyline slips away, gray and breathing, among Campos Dulces y Cigarros XXS, short of breath, while a one-legged stranger limps towards the bus stop. For 63 years, I have stood on this shore with paintbrush and clam pole in hand, Mother. And I have tried with all my heart to decipher the moving forms between the water and the trees, to make some sense out of them, a music, a rhyme, a rhythm, only to hear in my ear the salt breeze blowing monotone against the mainland. Glory to God, shouts the lame man before boarding the bus. Maria, looking out her window, overlooking the beach, throws her trash out into the street, hoping no one is looking. Only if I could have seen the bay as she did on the day of his self-execution, the infinite line circling back. A boy roller skates up to me a week later. For him, Mejia Street is yesterday and tomorrow, no stops or steps in between. For her, the town is nothing more than the gossipings of widows. An unclear, barely visible truth distorts her face. She hangs her wash up to dry. Nearby, a 13-year-old girl, unconscious of herself and looking strangely like Maria 5 decades ago, plays in the doorway. Tiene agua municipal aquí? No, says the girl. And if we did, I would not be consoled. What we need here are curves, curlicues, and loop-de-loops. Lots of them. It's that simple. On summer nights, Maria's younger brother, Manuel, would stand atop a hill near the precipice, wearing only his undershorts, and gaze out to the darkening masses of houses beyond. He would hear dogs barking, and the voices of children rising towards him in their innocence and anger. Sometimes he believed they were waves breaking against the shore.
Other times they were the cries of the rocks below trying to rend themselves from their own weight. Then he would disappear, turning inward and entering through the pores of his skin, caught between the rocks and the tide, only to discover still another gully, larger and emptier, filled with the same wailings of the children trapped on the other side. Next morning, clinging to her cello and singing songs of unspoken love, Maria would scour the hillside, calling out his name. Finding him propped up against a fence post or a tree, his mouth full of salt water, his eyes glazed over with fish.
Adair had a showing of his paintings one night, and so Bobby and I went to the opening, and that's when I got my first Annabelle. And I was just, and I knew immediately, when I saw this particular Annabelle, which I will show you in a while, I just walked up to him and said, "That's mine." Now, I didn't know how we were going to manage it financially. I said, "Bobby, you work that out with Adair, but I really, really want that picture." I think Annabelle is almost a reverse emotion of Jim. And I think I told him once, because the sculptures are so harsh to me, and some of them out at the hill really scare me almost. And I think they're like a reverse side of his personality. And I just told him one time, I said, "I think the McGee work is your dark side, and the Annabelle work is your light and loving and giving and warm side." And that's what I really do feel. Obviously, I can't see Annabelle. I see Jim's image, but to me, it's a feeling that it's Annabelle. Annabelle is who Annabelle is as part of Jim's personality. But I don't have I've read a lot of things about a lot of suggestions. Well, Annabelle, in fact, Jim said she's a little librarian from the Midwest and all of that type thing. Well, I don't see Annabelle that way. I see Annabelle is an integral part of Jim, but as the non-aggressive part of Jim. Whereas I really see the sculptures as an aggressive part of Jim. But every time I say Annabelle, I'm still seeing Jim's. Jim's face is in my mind, and it's just so. In fact, he's more like an Annabelle to me. His face is more like an Annabelle to me than Jim is, because his face is so beautiful and so sweet and so outgoing and loving and kind. And it's hard. I could see myself, if I could, watch Annabelle paint. And Annabelle would be painting and it would be Jim. But I find it hard in my mind to picture Jim doing Jim McGee's work. I find it really hard, really hard. I think there would, what would he be like? I mean, I wonder, I don't know. Would he be attacking something viciously or putting each thing very carefully down, like everything obviously is put very carefully down, but with all the force of the metals he uses and all of that kind of thing, that's really harsh to me. And yet, I know, and I have a feeling I'd rather, if I ever got to see either one of them do the real work, you know, apart from my picture, that I'd rather see Annabelle than Jim.
People mainly have just been fascinated by him. I mean, there's a real, and people who buy Annabelle's work want to know Jim. You know, they love to go to his house and, you know, see Annabelle in the context of working in her studio in a home, which is very different from James McGee. And they just love the work. I mean, I think Annabelle has she's really touched people's heartstrings here. You know, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist. So I haven't, you know, I used to think about it more than I do now. I've just kind of accepted it. Annabelle is Jim, really. I mean, I think Annabelle expressed something very real about James McGee.
Now, in the mist, it's covered with mist now. It's raining. You see those little hills over there? Those are the hills. That's where we're going. We're about, usually you can see my buildings from here. We're about, I'd say, 10 miles, 15 miles from here. And May Carson's truck stop is on the left side. We're seeing now a couple of trees, a couple of trailers. There's a place to get gas, a couple of gas pumps. And there is a couple flags up front, the American flag and the Texas flag, which at one point actually was a Puerto Rican flag, but Nathan thought she'd bought a Texas flag, but actually it was a Puerto Rican flag. And there's a little sign that says Cafe, no, right over there. And there, and May has done this incredible job of planting these pine trees around here, which she waters. It's quite something. And you park any, well, should have, I'm not doing back there. Back there. And there's a couple old wagons and covered wagons and a sign that says $5 blankets. You get these blankets from Mexico. And the wind is very strong right now. And now she's put this gift shop in, which is where you can see the stuff. It's painted, painted and glittered plaster of Paris. Statuary from Mexico. They can probably buy it for $2 or $3. And there's Indians and pictures of Elvis on velvet, and all sorts of little bows and arrows you can buy with little fluffy tips and stuff like that on it. Anyway, good hamburger. Should we go in? Somebody has been after to interview me forever, and I've always refused. It's only because this is European.
That's fine.
Oh, this is very windy still. Wow. You have that little rubber thing?
Can you just tell us your name?
May Carson.
How long have you known Jim?
20, almost.
And my beard was black.
Uh-huh, right. He was a young boy.
So you've known him since he first started working on that hill out there?
Uh-huh. In fact, I gave him the water to put the cement together for the first one, didn't I?
That's right.
Do you mind if I have a seat?
No.
So what's your opinion of the art out there?
Oh, it's great.
Yeah. Now, this is for a radio piece, so the radio audience can actually look at the art. So how would you describe it?
Pyramids. Is that good enough?
Sure. Why pyramids?
Because I think it's like level with the world, and I think it's all of that. I think he's got the same concept. And the sound up there is wonderful. Have you heard the sound? Other than the wind. You've been out here in the wind today.
And so you've been here 20 years?
Almost 19, yeah.
And before you came here, what were you doing?
I pulled trailers for Airstream all over the United States and Canada.
Uh-huh. And how'd you pick to stop here?
Well, I kept coming this way because of the, you know, it's kind of a back road.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that owned this place, kept trying to sell it to me, and it has nostalgia. I like it. So finally I ended up with it.
And there's, what, three of you live here?
My mother's here, yeah, three. No, we have a renter. There's four, really. We have a renter that's been there about 3-4 years, so...
So when you first ran into Jim and he said he was going to build this giant thing on the hill?
No, he didn't tell me that. Oh. He didn't tell me that. He just said he was going to build this building and wanted to know if he could borrow some water to put the cement together. And I told him, sure. So in another couple of years, after he finished that one, in another couple of years, he said, do you think you could loan me some water to build some more? And I said, sure. Why not? And he said, well, I'm going to build three this time. And I said, three? Did your ship come in or what? And he said, well, yes, kind of. So we started the other three.
So you didn't realize what he was going to use those
for? Well, he tried to tell me, but I'm kind of dumb. I didn't understand. It's like, yeah, we have a lot of squatters out here, so... So anyway, we ended up on the same side. We don't, none of us like squatters. All these people that come and just make a big mess and just, you know.
There's some kind of political work.
Oh, well, I'm the mayor, but I'm self-appointed.
You're the mayor. Did you have opposition?
No. They cheat. You get 7 votes when we put it up for vote. There's only 3 or 4 of us here, so.
And you got 7.
Yeah, they get 7. So I just keep my job. I'm not going to let them have it. They try to cheat.
Who's that?
The voters.
Oh, I see.
It's only 3 of them.
I've
been trying to get Jim to pay taxes for years, but he won't do it. I haven't got any taxes off of him yet. And this is a city.
Now, is it a sales tax or a land
use well,
tax or art tax?
Maybe an art tax, something. Maybe an art tax. I think he's great. It's wonderful. It really
have you
is.
Been in the buildings?
Sure, I've been in all of them.
Uh-huh. And how would you describe, if you were going to try to describe to somebody who'd never seen those pieces in there, how would you describe them?
I don't know, one of a kind, I guess. you'd have to describe it as that.
Right.
Maybe life.
It would be an image of life that has a lot of struggle.
Right. Right. He's had a lot of struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I just, you know, he really has. He's been an awful sick man for a lot of years. I think it's amazing. I like it. I like it. When he invites me up there, I go.
It's good. As mayor of the town, you're pleased.
Yeah, to have him over there, yeah. Of course, all of these people in this area, and we have a little hillbilly town over here, they all think he's a nut, you know. I even had some people that think he's a devil worshiper because of those pedestals in there. They've been up there peeking, you know. Yeah, they peek through them doors. So in place of them thinking it's something, put art on, they think it's... Oh, some kind of pulpit or something instead of a, you know, something to put art on. I just laughed. I just thought it was funny. I don't think so. And I said, no. He said, and there wasn't any work up there at that point. And they said, well, have you seen his work? And I said, no, not really. He told me, just call him and he'll show me. And they said, Omay, don't go. Don't go over there. but no.
They were concerned for your safety.
Yeah, right.
You look like somebody who can take care of.
Yeah, I can. He didn't ever frighten me.
In 20 years, only one person outside of my, again, small circle of friends and family, they asked me what this place is. And that was the 15-year-old son of a stonemason. Who said, Mr. McGee, while they were putting up all these things, Mr. McGee, what are you doing? Are you building a shopping center?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, God, that's a great answer to anybody. I said, yeah, it's going to be a shopping center. He says, well, are you going to have a boot store? And I said, yeah, we're going to have a boot store. He says, well, when you open up the shopping center, could you call me because I need a pair of boots.
I sent Jim out with Laura Bush. And, you know, I was amused because people were, you know, it's hard to know how to respond to him when when you, you know, you're looking at these, this art that you can't process instantaneously. So you have, you stand there and then to have him in that sort of Irish brogue reciting the titles. You know, Laura, of course, she's a great listener, so she was probably, you know, great listener and absorbed his voice well. But I wasn't there to see her face or to kind of see how she responded. She really likes Jim McGee a lot.
It had rained buckets 2 days before, and we went out the day before Laura was to come out with her friend and with her entourage. And it had rained, and all the buildings were covered with tarantulas. And we spent half a day picking, because the tarantulas come out of the ground. It was a big pour. And we were picking, we must have picked 40, 50 tarantulas from the walls and sort of scooted them out, saying, please, because I could just see our First Lady of Texas coming out there. And she's been very faithful. Laura had an exhibition of Annabelle Livermore paintings at her office in the State House in Texas, and has made the effort to go see a couple of Annabelle shows outside of Austin.
When he opened the door, did he like have a rock and kind of roll the rock so the door would just gradually open? You know, we're driving out to this desert, and the winds were so violent, so that it was like this huge sandstorm. And Jim, once we got out to the hill, I mean, and barely could open the doors to our car. And then Jim walks with the staff, and he has this white beard. I mean, he looked like Moses. But instead of like the parting of the Red Sea, it was like the parting of the Red Sands. And we walked up. I'll never forget, we walked kind of pushing against the wind. And he, of course, they're those great big steel French doors. So they're solid doors. And in opening them, he knew how dangerous it could be with those kinds of winds. So he carried a very, very heavy stone. I mean, I don't know how, you know, 50 pounds or so, and put it in front of the door, one side of the door, and then rolled it just a little bit, and then the door kind of, you know, would hit up against it. And then he'd roll it a little more, and the door would hit up against it. And then when it was finally open, that one door, I'll never forget, he asked me to hold that part while he went and opened the other side. Well, you know, it was really a pretty dangerous situation, because the wind got behind it and closed it. If it had gone the other way, I would have been a fly, like being squashed against a wall. But it was being opened again by the wind. The wind got behind it, and the door just kind of threw me. I was kind of thrown off this onto the ground. I don't know how many feet it threw me. But I bruised my heel. Now, that's an Old Testament image, you know, bruising your heel. I bruised my heel and couldn't walk on my heel for like 2 months. It was so you're always, when I send people out to the hill with Jim, I'm always hopeful that they'll come back. He opened that one that has that old altarpiece. Did you study art history that opens twice? You know, he has got that one altarpiece where you open two doors and then there are two more doors that open. When he opened it, there were all these moths that flew out too. And he opened them. I guess they, of course, it's out in the middle of the desert and it's somewhat protected, but you can't protect it from, of course, they didn't damage it, but some moths, I think, had gotten up within the altarpiece and on the glass, so they wouldn't damage the actual piece. But when he opened the doors, a lot of the larvae had given birth to these moths. So these, I mean, it seemed like hundreds of moths flying out. So this man with this long beard, and they're experiences you don't forget.
I enjoy working on things over long periods of time. I get satisfaction from that, whether anybody sees the work or buys it or anything else. I just enjoy that. I think my process is very, very slow. So a hill, as I call it, or whatever I've done out there, is certainly amenable to that, because
guess I've been working on it for decades at this point. I have one more building to do the interiors for. And again, I probably will, I'm setting aside the next 10 to 15 years probably to get that done. And I've already started them in the last year or two. Very, very piecemeal. And I'll just be working on those.
Yeah, it's hard to explain. I don't fully understand it, but you know what would move someone to do something like that so far from anywhere and really not trying to create a pilgrimage site, but just kind of all by himself. I mean, I don't know. You know, it's kind of leaving his mark on the earth. It has that sense of permanence, I think, and having grown out of the earth, and like it will always be there.
We just come up over a ridge, and we're on top of a mesa, which is the hill, and we're seeing a complex of four buildings that are made out of rock on pedestals. And they're actually a mile away. This leg of the driveway is a mile long. Yes, this is. I put this road in by driving on it. Now go slow up here, because we're going to hit a bumpy right here. This is a windstorm, and I think that's sand blowing in with the clouds.
First boy. No kidding. Last night, I'm back at the black spot of my eye way back. I see this old coot in a drain ditch, floating around in an inner tube, revolving dark and watery. Second boy. I seen him too, but he sure wasn't in no inner tube, and he sure wasn't floating around in no drain ditch. He was rolling down the dark road in back of the tin church in my red wagon, hollering like a high-pitched woman, yes, yelling, Saint Ida this, Saint Ida that. Never had a good ass to begin with, too flat, too flat. And I tell you, that wasn't the first time I seen him back there with his arm hooked up to an IV. Cut to a wet summer night in an eastern city of red brick. Older, middle-aged man sitting alone among tall, leafy trees near an empty parking lot, a silhouetted steeple behind him. And then beneath his breath, he begins, gotta clean up, 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 gotta first, gotta go, and then the man, his face smeared with lipstick, turns to address an audience. Sometime, when I'm out here like this near the drain hole, and I'm drawn to drains, no matter the time of day or night or year for that matter, especially if they're holes, sucking soul holes, I begin to see light exploding from trunks of trees, spark-like stones struck together, brighter than a sun uplifted. Because you see, I've been slithering around on this wet ground on all fours among these shadows for so long now, but the trees and me, we kind of understand one another as in the gradualness of our less and less, as in the meaning of a puckered up lip or a twitching eye, or an oar digging into a pickled lake, no matter the why. Like, I'm beginning to think maybe my meat must be slipping away from my mind, drip by drip, leaking southward toward my throat, passing the stem and the stern man, probing the hair under his armpit and the warm spit in his mouth, splashing around his scrotum and over his toes. The smell of night, say, after a rainstorm near my soul. And then, by God,
right when I'm in the middle of drinking him in, she'd walk out again from a dark corner into a full view of Delph between 13th and Little West 12th Street. A large 17th century Dutch woman carrying a basket of breaded chinaware along a canal, droplets of sunlight touching the Protestant steeple behind her, following a brief shower near the meat district, and we seven or eight of us leather boys kicking up our heels and sniffing the spill on the second floor along the shaft would hope for more in the back room near the tub, Bob. But that damn chore woman. Jesus. She wouldn't just keep on trundling through as though nothing were happening around her, rattling on in her lowland Dutch, splicing together those guttural vowels beneath the bowels of 832 Washington Street, her blue and white clatter trap, her broken china of Delphish boys wearing wooden shoes strapped to rubber toys, pants pulled down, ricocheting from wall to dark wall, only to fall by sunrise, our cocks aching into the Hudson River.